ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Juliana Nkrumah was born near the coast of Ghana in West Africa at a place known as Salt Pond. She started her life in her family's rambling home with dozens of relatives, their lives crisscrossing over each other. But when her family situation deteriorated, education became a lifeline for Juliana. She went on to teach in Zimbabwe, but it became a dangerous place for those who were outspoken. So Juliana and her husband began a new life here in Australia. Juliana has been awarded an Order of Australia and a Human Rights Medal for her work with immigrant and refugee women, especially in the fight against female genital mutilation. There'll be some sensitive content in this interview, but more than anything, it is the story of a remarkable woman. Juliana, welcome.
Thank you, Sally.
Can you tell me about this house in Salt Pond in Ghana? What was it like?
My house in Salt Pond is a generational home. It's a concrete building on a rock. So you can stand at the gate and look down to the middle of town, which we call Nkwantanan, four roads meeting together. And you can see who is coming home. So for Christmas, for Easter, we children stand there. And when we spot who is coming home, we all run down the hill to carry their bags with them and bring them home. It's named after my great-grandmother's big sister. There were nine of them. My great-grandmother was number nine.
Wow.
So she had the name Nkrumah, number nine, Nkrumah, ninth born child. But our great-grandmother's, the firstborn child was called Sunkwa. Sunkwa meaning cry for life, a cry for life, Sunkwa. So the house is called Sunkwa Villa. And you go to Prabil, which is our suburb, and ask for Sunkwa Villa. Everybody will take you there. You never get lost. The two coconut trees are gone. The Swiss oven that my aunties used to bake their bread for the markets are also gone. But you just ask for Sunkwa Villa and everybody will take you there.
As a little girl, who was the softest person in that house for you?
My grandmother. I had nobody else. I looked up to nobody else. It was my grandmother or no one else. Even though I had my cousins, my aunties, my great aunties, my great grandmother, but the person who, as much as she was my disciplinarian, she was also my softest person and my go-to person was my grandmother.
When you think of her, when you're a little girl looking at her, what kind of woman did she look like to you at that time?
My grandmother was petite and round. So I folded into her. She carried me on her back. She carried me on her side. And I held on to her cloth, her skirt. In Australia, we say skirt. I say cloth in Tamil. I held her onto her cloth to go everywhere. And she couldn't go without me. If she went and I couldn't find her, I was totally devastated with images of she's not coming back. What's going to happen to me? So, yeah, that was the images of my grandmother.
Juliana, what were some of the sayings that she would say to you again and again when you were with her?
I think some of the things that my grandmother would say to me are her soft words. Like when I was hungry, she would say, "Oh, I'll come to wa," and then I'll nod. And she'd say, "Okay, yo, merba. Okay, I'm coming. Wait for me," sort of, you know. And I'll go, no, I'm not waiting. I'm going with you wherever you're going. That's right. But she was the woman who was a disciplinarian in the family to all the people, a little older than me and a little after me. She had my mother as her only child, and then I came along. Then later my siblings came along. But my uncles feared her. Because if you did something wrong and she got you, you got the ginger.
What's the ginger?
Yes, so she would crush ginger and put it on your backside. And then the only way you pay attention, but it's also medicinal. So they were scared of her because she would give you the ginger.
How much internal politics was there in the house with different parts of the family, different members of the family all living together, trying to figure out how it fits together? People disagree. There can be love, but also a lot of difficulty sometimes.
There was a lot of politics. I remember two of my older grand aunts, who were one after the other in birth ranking, they used to quarrel a lot. And when they got to quarreling, everybody stayed out of their quarrels. Only because if you went in to try and settle it, you would be the third person. They would come together against you. So when they started their quarrels, nobody got involved with it. But the deep politics, I did not understand because I was a kid. I was very, very young. I left my grandmother's when I was just up to 7 years old. So I didn't notice the politics until later when I'd left university and actually stayed overseas that I realized that there was deep, deep, deep politics in my home that has now totally devastated the family and brought a lot of distrust to such a place that was so trusting for us children and loving for us children. The love's gone, the trust gone, and it's become a place of a lot of suspicion and one that people don't want to go to except when there's a funeral, which is sad, very, very sad.
I can hear there's a lot of sadness for you with that.
That, for me, is sad also because my grandmother's gone, my mother is gone, and so I'm the eldest now, and I don't have that trust to be able to go into that space.
So at seven, you were moved away to your father's house in another area. What was it like for you having to leave your grandmother, given that the bond was so strong? What did you say to her?
I don't know how they got me to go, but my mother's favourite aunt was a teacher in Kumasi, and she lived there with her family. Because she was my mum's favourite aunt, she was my favourite grand aunt. But I never thought she was even my grand aunt. I called her aunt. Everybody called her aunt teacher because she was a teacher. So we called all our aunties and uncles by their profession. So she was aunt teacher. And aunt teacher always came home to visit her mum and dad. And so I became attached to her a little bit. So I was happy to be going away to Kumasi with aunt teacher. I don't know whether they took me in the night or whatever, but when I was leaving, I didn't see my grandmother. So I went with aunt teacher. And then she had to deliver me to my dad. And I was with my dad alone in the house. But I used to get hallucinations from the very first night. I used to hallucinate and cry for my grandmother. I used to do that a lot, and apparently I got sick, really, really sick with fever. And somebody told my dad to bring my grandmother back. If they didn't bring her, they didn't think I would survive. So my grandmother had to come and stay with me, and she stayed for 6 months.
They're big experiences at seven, Julianne.
I think it's one of the biggest trauma in my life. Yeah, but, you know, those days nobody talked of trauma and that kind of thing. But it was a big trauma to be separated in that manner.
The relationship between your mum and dad, what was that like, and why were you sent to be with your dad?
My mum and dad never got married. They were boyfriend and girlfriend, and my mum got pregnant. But because she was the only child, my grandmother insisted she kept the child, she kept the pregnancy. And so when I was born and given to my grandmother. So she was my mom. When I came to the age of awareness, my grandmother was my mom. That's why the attachment. And then my mother had to then go to college, and then she got married after college. And so she then kept her family, and I was with my grandmother.
Did that hurt you that you weren't with your mom?
No. I was with my grandmother. And yeah, that's what it is. When I grew older, I remember that my mother and my sister or my siblings had to go and live with my mom's husband in another town in Ho, West Volta region. And I'd gone with them. But I remember my time in that house was very sad. I used to be very, very sad because I wanted my grandmother. And I don't know the correspondence that took place between my mom and my father, but when I grew older, I found a letter that my father was saying, he would not let another man look after his daughter, so they should bring me to him.
What was it like for you at your dad's house, particularly when your stepmother was on the scene? Was it difficult for you, Julia?
It was very difficult with my stepmother, because I got the impression right from the beginning my stepmother didn't like me. And so I made a decision to fight for myself right from the beginning. And I was about 8, 9. And then I realized this woman doesn't like me. I'm going to be in a lot of trouble. I have to find a way out of her shackles, you know. So I made the decision to work hard on my studies. That was my way out.
So it sounds like education was a real escape, a real lifeline for you, given what was happening at home.
Absolutely. I made sure that I was a first girl. I did very, very well, performed really well at school because that was my go-to place and that was a thing that nobody could take away from me. So, yes, I focused on that. And my father realized that and decided to invest in that. Mm. So that's how, before I turned 11, just on the verge of my 11th birthday, my father sent me to a girls' boarding school for middle school.
When you were at your dad's house, what did your stepmother expect of you with chores and work that you needed to do around the house?
I had to do everything. Had to do everything. A girl was to do the chores in the house. So you did the sweeping, the laundry, you did the garden. In that part of my life, I did everything. Everything that needed doing. I had to do all my chores before I could pick a book to sit down to read.
When you were sent to boarding school, what was that like? What was the motto like for the boarding school that you were sent to?
So I went to 2 boarding schools, but the motto of my high school is the one that keeps me going. And the motto says, live pure, speak true, right wrong, follow the king. So when we meet our friends from our school, you say, live pure, and they respond, speak true. And that sets you to know that this person went to Wesley Girls High School.
What kind of place did English play in school life compared to the language that you might speak at home?
So at home in Salt Pond, I spoke Fanti. I was 5 years old in primary school when we were told to speak English and we were on the playground. And I was found speaking Fanti. And somebody came with a piece of cardboard with speak English written on it, on a jute string, and popped it on my head. So I was wearing this, and I was made to wear it across town home. And the first thing my grandmother said was, what is this? And my uncle was like, oh, she doesn't speak English. She was caught speaking Fanti. And my grandmother was in horror. And she said, oh, in Sibrofa, don't you understand English? And I was like, I will speak English. And I had to wear this thing back to school the following day. And from then, I refused to speak. I couldn't. Had to speak English during school time. Then I came back home to my grandmother when I was in university. And I was talking with her and she said, what are you talking about? I said, what do you mean, what am I talking about? And she said, your Fanti is not going right. So I was thinking in English and translating to Fanti. And that's how I lost my language. I still speak it one-on-one, but not royal language. I do public speaking extremely well in English, can't do it in Fanti. It's a different art, totally different art form. And I don't have that art form.
You start to learn gospel singing at at high school and you join this group called the Joyful Way Singers. How important was that for you?
Oh, my God, Joyful Way was my life. 2 things were my life, Wesley Girls High School and Joyful Way. And Joyful Way, I made a lot of deep friends who are still my friends up to today. So it was more than being just a member of the Scripture Union, you are ministering. So you learned the songs, you walked the right way as a Christian, and then you went out to sing and not proselyte. You went out to evangelize. So that was my, and it got us to know the boys from two of the boys' schools in Cape Coast. So we were in the girls' school, and then there were boys from Fan Spring School, which is my husband's school, and boys from Addis Adel College who came every week for practice, and then sometimes we went out to evangelize together. Then during the school holidays, we evangelized together in the capital city.
So you're there enjoying the music. The boys from these two schools are also involved. A certain young man comes to shake your hand. What do you do?
I turn my head. I don't know what it was. My husband is very striking. He is still. But then he put out his hand to greet me. I put out my hand and I turned my head away from him. And he was like, what was that? What was that about? Yeah.
What do you think really attracted to you once you turned your head back where you should be, to be able to look at him and observe him? What drew you in, do you think?
Do you know, I don't even know how, I don't even know how the relationship then grew from there. But my husband is very caring, and he just approached me, and he was really caring at listening to me. And then he used to come and visit me at my father's place. He would come and we would have a chat, we would do walks on the campus. And yeah, he was really a good friend. He became a very, very good friend.
You got married. How important was that for you to have a sense of starting, having that relationship and hoping to start your own family, given that you had great love from your grandma, but the family links had been a little bit broken for you?
For me, it was a matter of a desire to build my own family. Mm. So one of the things that happened when I was about 17, 18, when my stepmother gave me a very hard time, an incident happened. I'd come home from Wesley Girls High School. I was a leader in the school, but at home I was almost the maid in the home. And I had this strange relationship, personality sort of thing. And then I came home one day and my stepmother was really hostile to me. And somebody, and my other stepsister, came to me and said, oh, you know, when you are away in school, a lot was said about you by my stepmother. And one of the things that she said was that you were a hindrance in the family, in her marriage. And I was like, why would I be a hindrance in anybody's marriage? So I went off to get water to come and do the washing, laundry. And then my stepmother came. As soon as I came into the compound to pour the water from the bucket into the tray to do the washing, she said to me, hey, what are you doing here? Why haven't you done the dishes? And I said, hang on a minute. I don't need the sun to do the dishes. I need the sun to dry the clothes. So I'm doing the clothes first. And then she started on me. At that point, I had had it. And there was an altercation. And in that, I said to her, I'm going to leave this house because I know where my mother is. I'm going to leave this house and not be a hindrance to your marriage no more. Because when I get married, I don't want a hindrance in my marriage. So that set me up to say, okay, if my husband would have me any time to get married to him, I would get married and set up a family that that would, you know, show my words, you know.
Your husband and his family got the opportunity to go to Zimbabwe in the early 1980s with a job. And the ties between Zimbabwe and Ghana at that time were very, very strong, and for a number of years, because Robert Mugabe was married to Sally, who was from Ghana. You were like almost sibling
brother
countries.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, that was in 1982, soon after the war in Zimbabwe. So that was early stages of Mugabe's rule in Zimbabwe. So Ghanaians were very favoured, if you like, in that sense, yeah.
And Ghana had got its own independence very early compared to the rest of sub-Saharan Africa.
Well, Ghana was the first country to be independent in sub-Saharan Africa in 1957. And then Kwame Nkrumah actually made it his duty and almost a religious duty for him to ensure that all other African countries could become independent. So Robert Mugabe was one of the people, one of the leaders in different African countries who went to Ghana to study and also to do their political studies.
That pan-African thinking was very strong, which he led.
Yeah.
What was it like coming to Zimbabwe, especially Harare in the early 80s, because there were still a lot of white Zimbabweans around and a lot of the previous inequalities and practices, they were still there.
They were, but I didn't understand them, see, because I had grown up in Ghana where we didn't know apartheid, we didn't understand apartheid. I'd actually read for English literature Cry the Beloved Country by Alan Paton.
From South Africa,
which talked about apartheid. But do you think that we would have spent time looking at the whole issue of apartheid? No, it had no day-to-day relevance to my life in Ghana. So when I came to Zimbabwe, I came into that apartheid system. In my home, because it was an ambassadorial home, we had a gardener, a man who looked after the grounds. We didn't have a cook because my mother-in-law was doing the cooking. But the man who looked after the grounds also looked after the house, did the cleaning and other things. But we noticed very quickly that he went away. At 6 o'clock, he left. He left our area and went, and I didn't know where he went, but apparently he went back to the
township.
My husband, though, was teaching in the township. It took a long time for me to understand this whole thing about township because we were in the white area. We went to church with white people. We went to university where there were a lot of black people, but also white people. So my life in Zimbabwe for some time was a little bit different until I started teaching in Harare itself and had a lot of students from the townships in my class.
Your mother-in-law, who'd moved over from Ghana with your husband, was quite the cook. And that brought together a personal connection with the Mugabes because of her cooking. Is that right?
Yes. I don't even know the story behind how Mrs. Mugabe got to know that my mother-in-law could cook dokwan, we call kenke, is made from maize. And when she found that out, she said to my mother-in-law, "Oh, Mugabe, Robert really likes kenke." So my mother-in-law was like, "I cook it all the time. I'll cook it for him." So every Thursday, the car would come from Mr. Mugabe's house to collect their lot of kenke for the week.
So this is a real Ghanaian delicacy that he'd got to like in Ghana.
Yes, because kenke is a daily meal that we eat. And, you know, Zimbabweans eat sadza from maize.
In South Africa, it's pap.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, pap's like sadza.
That's right.
But kenke is different. You ferment it, you cook it, and then you steam it in the leaf, either dried corn leaf or banana leaf. So my mother-in-law used to make it. He loved it, so she used to make it for him all the time.
So you were teaching sociology in Zimbabwe, and you were talking about current things that were unfolding. So you'd have newspaper articles and other things. How did you start to realise, or did someone give you a warning that it could be dangerous having material in the classroom which could be seen as critical of the Mugabe regime, even in those early days?
Totally. I loved to make my teaching real to people. So these are older people who, like principals of schools, who were upgrading their qualifications. And I would go to school and I would take the articles and I would teach them the concepts and I would say, look at this article and that article and compare and look at how your country is trending. I was doing that, you know, naively, but apparently it was putting people's backs up. They wouldn't say to me in the class, though. So they went to one of the students who was an administrator in the college where I was teaching, who was my friend, and said quietly to her, "Warn your friend, otherwise there'll be trouble for her." So she came and quietly said, "Mrs. Nkrumah, you need to be very careful with the examples that you are giving, especially from the media articles. I would advise that you stay away from those media articles." So overnight, I said to myself, okay, let them go and do their own thing. I'll just teach them the concepts. Yeah, that was really frightening, yeah.
And in Zimbabwe at that time, people were starting to disappear, Juliana, Zimbabweans, but also foreigners who'd come in as well.
And that was the reason why I suddenly got the message when the woman said that to me, because there were teachers from my husband's school who had not come back to school the following day and nobody could trace where they'd been.
Was that scary for you?
Totally.
And for your family as well?
See, before then, my mother had come to Zimbabwe, and my husband is very political-minded and very astute, and he reads a lot. So my husband used to talk about Ghanaian politics, and my mother got frightened with the way he spoke and said to him, "You guys cannot come back to Ghana because your ideas are so dangerous. So think about where you would go." She was quite frightened with the way we spoke, yeah.
This is Conversations with Sally Sara. Find more Conversations on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Juliana, it wasn't safe for you there anymore, and it wasn't viable for you to go back to Ghana. Why did you and your husband decide on Australia?
Don't know, he did. Well, his friend had... We met a couple of people in Zimbabwe who were Ghanaians who were from Australia. So we thought, then his friend got admission to study in Australia and told him, look, this is the way to get to Australia. Why don't you consider it? So he and his friend, he had been completing forms, applying to schools. I wasn't bothered. I was looking after our child and going to work. I was so caught up with working, teaching the University of Zimbabwe. And he just carried on with his applications. When he got it, then he said to me, I've got entry into University of New South Wales. This is what's going to cost us. This is what we have to do. And then he gave me the whole plan. You know, I sometimes joke and I say that was the first time I just followed my husband.
What did you know about Australia at that stage? How little was your knowledge of what it was going to be like for you?
Very little. What it was going to be like for me, I didn't know. But what I knew about it was from geography in high school when, you know, Miss also taught us about the artesian wells and the orange orchards. And that's what I knew about Australia. So when I came and I told my year group that I was in Australia, all my year group girls were like, oh my goodness, Miss also did very well by you. But as to life in Australia, I had absolutely no clue. And I'm grateful that Australia was an English-speaking country because I don't know how I would have coped if it hadn't been an English-speaking country and I couldn't read the signs and hear what was said.
Juliana, can you take me to that time in 1988 when you arrive in Australia for the very first time? What is it like?
Rainy. That was my first impression. I was saying to my husband, why have you come to a place where it rains every day? But this was March, April 88, so it rained every day. Parramatta River got flooded. But also the people. But we're in the University of New South Wales, so it was all university students. But when I went into Kingsford, into the streets, I saw a lot of Asian people. And I was like, I'm confused. Isn't this supposed to be white people and Aborigines? Why do I have so many Asian people? So I was very, very confused as to what I was seeing around me, but I needed to adjust.
What sort of richness did you discover when you started to see how many people from how many different places were also living in your area?
It was very interesting because once I started living, I had to get childcare. My family home care worker was Greek. And then I went to work in the laundromat. And the woman who was the administrator there was Greek. But I didn't know she was Greek. And in Ghana, when you don't understand what somebody is saying, you say, why are you talking Greek? And I actually said that one day. The administrator was very offended. And I didn't see why she was offended, because that was my way of saying, I don't understand. But it was interesting that on the factory floor, we had Fijian, Indian, we had a whole lot of people. And I was like, what is this place? I hadn't come to fully understand the diversity. I hadn't come to fully appreciate what multiculturalism was about. I was literally observing all this from a distance, even though I lived it.
The laundromat, what was that like as work for you after you'd been teaching?
Oh, that was painful. It was painful because I was like, why am I here? So 5 months I spent there. Every Saturday, I would buy the newspaper and apply for jobs. I applied for over 100 jobs and got no response, absolutely no response. The closest I got was tutoring. And I used to cry every day thinking, is this my life? And then my sociology lecturer made a mistake to come to Australia and visit his friend. Her friend, and then she got in touch with me, and I said to her, why did you continue teaching us sociology when you didn't lead to a job? Why didn't you advise me to do social work? You know, I just went through all my frustration on her. But it was really, really, my husband used to cry that he had taken somebody's daughter and put her in this situation. It was really painful.
What did you understand about multiculturalism and how people fitted together and where you fitted in that puzzle as a Ghanaian? Did some people treat you well and others not so well?
I didn't understand multiculturalism at all at that time. Some treated me well. Others, I wasn't looking. Those times, to tell you the truth, I didn't stumble upon racism, for example, until a very long time. When I sat back and started, because I started work and I was doing work in policy, and I started looking at why things were the way they were. But in the initial stages, I was on survival mode. Had to go to work, had to pay the rent, bring the food to the table. My husband was a student. We just had to survive. And in that space, you don't think, you just do. So you found yourself in a place where you could pull away and start observing society and analysing society.
You were having a difficult time, by the sounds of it, Juliana, really challenging. Given your connection with your grandmother, were your thoughts with her, even though you were so, so far away from each other?
My thoughts were with my grandmother all the time. My thoughts were with my grandmother when I looked at my paycheck and I couldn't get anything left behind to send to her. That was another killing point for me. So what I did was, as we got on and we moved forward, I was able to then learn how to tape record my voice and my children's voice and send it home to my grandmother and my mum.
There's nothing quite like that. We use that as a family sometimes. And your grandma must have played those tapes again and again and again until they almost broke, did they, Juliana?
She did. Mm. She did, yeah. Mm. And she was happy that she felt I was in a good place there. But I was aching not being able to send back any money for her to continue, because she was getting on and she was still working.
Eventually you got news that your grandmother was very, very unwell. How hard was that for you, Julia?
Prior to that news, my husband had to go home to his brother's funeral, and he had gone to visit my grandmother in my hometown. And my grandmother had given him a message for me that she was tired and she wanted to go. And she was happy that I was okay, and she was happy that I was in a good family, like my husband was looking after me well, so he should come and tell me that she was tired, she wanted to go. So when he came, his message was, he had an additional message of his own, and he said, I think you better plan to go. And I said, oh, but I'm studying, I'm doing this course, I can't stop. Then the next I heard was that she was very ill, in a coma, and I couldn't get home until she passed, yeah.
It sounds like that bond has been so, so strong for you all the way through your life, and even now it's really strong for you.
My grandmother was my life. If I'd ever been close to anybody besides my husband, it's my grandmother.
What was it like going home for her funeral?
You know, funerals are not in my hands. They are, oh, because my mother was alive, it was in her hands. But I felt like I've done my job by being there. But I asked my mother, did my grandmother say anything to you to say to me? And she said no. And I was very disappointed.
She didn't have a final message for you, but what message did you have for her when you were sitting there gently with her?
Thank you. I knew the suffering she'd been through for all of us. For me, she fought for me. My father really respected my grandmother. And he made sure I got to a good place for her, as his thanksgiving for her. So thank you.
How much of your grandmother do you think is part of who you are, the way that you think, the way that you speak to your kids, the way you see people around you? How much of her is carried with you, do you think?
I think I carry a lot more than I think I know myself or appreciate or acknowledge. My grandmother was a very strong woman. She was not educated. She went to class 3. And she was pulled out because she was a girl. And she was adamant that it's okay, she will cook. And for the rest of her life, she cooked and sewed. She was also very kind. She was poor, but she was very kind. Very, very kind. And she stood for justice. So I have an uncle who grew up to be a chief justice in my country. And there was a point when he had a problem with his dad, and his dad was considered the important person in the family at that time. Nobody stood for him but my grandmother in her poverty. She said, okay, you're my son, I'll look after you. And people were shocked in the family. She never begged. She was poor, she never begged. She was very independent of thought, and she did what she wanted to do. So I remember that my older aunties used to say, oh, my grandmother will go and sell her food and will not tell them how much profit she made. And if you asked her how much profit she made, she said, what has it got to do with you? Not knowing that when she went, she fed all the people with mental illness in the town.
How much do you think that sense of social justice played into the work that you started doing in Australia, working with immigrant and refugee women, supporting them, fighting for them? Was some of that from your grandma?
I never used to think that. There were times, all the time, when you asked me who is your mentor or who has been your mentor, I always would say my grandmother. And I thought that all of that social justice thinking came from my school, from Western Girls High School. But on reflection, I realized that it was always there. And I used to joke and say my grandmother was a feminist, but she didn't even know the name feminist. That's right. So it came from that milk, you know, if you like. And for me, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're being unjust to somebody, you hear me. And I know people say you give somebody a voice. Everybody's got a voice. What do you give to is access to the expression of that voice. And my aim was to give access to the expression of the voice of refugee women and migrant women, but especially the African refugee women when they came from 2000, even before 2000, 1995, that kind of area, because I did international advocacy for refugees, especially the Sierra Leone refugees. Because I'd been to Sierra Leone and I loved Sierra Leone. And to hear that it was on fire, I couldn't handle that. I was able to join a group of people to advocate for Sierra Leonean refugees in Beijing at the NGO conference, Fourth World Conference on Women. I made advocacy for refugee women and supported the Sudanese refugee women on their quest to get access to Australia.
How rewarding was that work for you, given you'd arrived here yourself and found it really difficult initially to watch these women grow?
They had to grow. I had found it difficult initially, but I had found people who believed in me and gave me opportunity. And I'd grown with that opportunity. And I needed them to understand that you don't just come to Australia and sit still because the government is giving you Centrelink benefits. No, no, no. You've got to come and understand that you have a contribution to make so somebody else can come too. So I did a lot of training with my good friends. We opened the door. We did human rights training and all kinds of training that people needed to be able to feel that their right to get a voice, then their right to use their voice, and their right to contribute to this country. It was very important to me.
One of the issues that you've dealt with is female genital mutilation, FGM, which some of these women have experienced in Africa and other places, others that that practice has been brought here to Australia. If people don't understand what FGM is, what's the simplest way that you explain it?
It's a traditional practice and a custom that demands of a woman to go through a particular operation so that they can access social, economic, political status as women. So let's not look at the operation. The operation is horrifying as it is. But without the operation, a woman is unable to access economic, social, political structures as a woman.
So being able to get married, being respected in the community,
a rite of passage,
being seen as a woman and rather than a girl?
Yes, totally. So how do you get away from that? How do you shake that? If you don't go through that process, then the society ostracizes you. So if in your society, you cannot be deemed a woman if you haven't been through that process, it becomes the responsibility of mother, who herself would have been a survivor of that practice, to ensure that she prepares her daughter to be able to become a woman.
And that's one of the complications, isn't it? In many, many cases, even though it's a community expectation, it is the women who are carrying out this mutilation of often their own younger family members. It's become perpetuated. It's women doing this to young girls.
It's
how do you get your head around that?
It's patriarchy. It's very interesting that we don't understand that patriarchy uses its victims to become custodians. So the woman is herself survived. She doesn't like it. But somehow that is her way of getting status in a patriarchal society. It's a conundrum. I sit and I think about it a lot and I say, without that status, she has no power in a patriarchal system. It's almost like a woman is cajoled, groomed into saying, oh, you are doing right if you are a custodian and ensure that the next generation become the same. And so the women wear it as a badge of honor. Having said that then, you know that the women themselves, a mother will not circumcise her child. A mother will present her child for circumcision. So there's a whole system around it. And in the system, there are hierarchies. And within that hierarchy, there's mysticism. So its belief system is guided by all these taboos. And you sort of do not have a wiggle way around it. This is what we don't understand. When we only look at the operation, we've got it wrong. We can't stop female circumcision by only saying, put the knife down. Put the knife down, but what about the structure? And that is where my strength is, in helping people to understand the structure and working with the structure. So it's demanded by patriarchy, or if you like, the men. But also, when you go deep into it, you realize that the men have been made to believe. So what they do is they sit back and allow the women to do their dirty business for them, making the women think that they've got authority and power.
How do you convince women to stop this practice? What actually works?
When I started the work on female genital mutilation, I went into my principal policy officer and I said, she was, oh, thank God you're here. Now you're going to help us stop female genital mutilation. I said, no, I'm not. And she was, I said, no, I am not. Neither are you. The women themselves are going to do that. And how do we get them to understand and do that? You've got to understand that they've got brains and they've got a sense of understanding. So feed them the information. So what we did was we fed information about the health effects. Because a lot of people did not make any connection between the circumcision operation and the lasting health effects. Number two, we taught them that it's not every woman in the world who goes through this, because they were taught to know that every woman goes through it. No, which means it's not every woman who is having these health effects. And then when they've understood that, then you, in Australia, you start working around the law that the Australian government has made and why they've made the law. And you just link it to day-to-day simple laws like the seatbelt law, bicycle helmet law, bodily protection, protection of bodily integrity. That's things. And then the final one we did was to link it to marriage. Would you be sure and guarantee that your daughter will marry somebody from your community? If yes, then maybe you should. But if you don't know, then you oughtn't. Because if you do, and they fall into the hands of somebody who doesn't know about this practice, they will not get married to that person who they love. How are you going to deal with that?
How confronting was it for you? Because in your part of Ghana, this practice wasn't carried out.
The first time I heard about female genital mutilation was in high school in literature, but my teacher didn't talk about it.
So you didn't understand?
No, she didn't. I don't think she understood herself. We read about Mutoni who had to do this thing, and it was, yeah, we just read the literature and went on off with it. Number two was in Zimbabwe when my girlfriend, a Ghanaian, came with an article that had been written by a Ghanaian journalist. And the Ghanaian journalist talked about FGM and then talked about Northern Ghana. And she was infuriated. And I said to her, but it's about Northern Ghana. What's your problem? But when I came here and then I was to host Behan Raswerk, who was the president of Inter-Africa Committee Against Traditional Practices, coming into New South Wales the weekend before the law was passed in New South Wales, meeting African people, their leaders, and showing us a video of a child being circumcised. Oh, my God. I ran out of the room. I couldn't stand the scream. I ran with my two-year-old out of the room until it was over. And that woman said to me, I want you to lead this in New South Wales. I said, you don't know me. I'm not even an Ethiopian, I said. Yeah? And then she went away. They went to Parliament. They had the law. And then the men in the community came back to me and said, the position is available. Apply for it. And I said, but my Ethiopian friend is there. Why don't you ask her to apply for it? And they said, we know you. We know you can lead us. So I went in, applied for the position as everybody does. It wasn't given to me on a silver platter. And I took that responsibility to say, if it's got an African face, I'm not wearing it. And that was what pushed me to really work on this issue.
You've ended up through your work, particularly with immigrant and refugee women. You've been appointed as a member of the Order of Australia, won a human rights medal. How do you think your grandmother would reflect on you achieving these things?
She wouldn't understand. When I got the Order of Australia, my grandmother was gone and my mum was gone too. The people who understood were my father's family. My father was quite proud, but they understood because they are an educated mob and they celebrated it. My friends in joyful way celebrated it. My grandmother wouldn't have understood. She would have asked, oh, now I see that, what does it mean? She would have asked that. And then she would have gone away in her own quiet way to smile to herself, because I promised that I would learn English. I know she was very proud of me. I went to university when she was there. But she kept it always in her heart. Yeah.
How do you reflect on what this whole journey has been for you?
For me, it's also a journey of faith. I walk the path that God allows me to. And when He opens an opportunity, I walk in and just do and be. I don't wear anything on my shoulder. I sometimes even forget to wear my pin because I don't think that is what it is. For me, the important thing is seeing that injustice and righting that wrong. That's all there is to it.
Juliana, it has been such a pleasure to be able to sit and listen to your story. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Sally. Thank you for hearing.
My guest today was Juliana Nkrumah. Today's conversation was produced by Alice Moldovan. Our executive producer is Carmel Rooney. Conversations is made on the lands of the Gadigal, Turrbal and Jagera peoples. I'm Sally Sara. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.